Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest mysterious poisoning of another former Russian spy in the UK, this time Colonel Sergei Skripal, a retired Russian military intelligence GRU officer who was one of four prisoners Russia swapped for 10 deep-cover sleeper agents planted by Moscow in the US who were exchanged in 2010. Luke Harding, the former Moscow bureau chief of The Guardian, who was expelled by the Kremlin and is the author of A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and his latest book, Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House, joins us. We'll discuss whether this latest hit involving a mysterious unknown substance was ordered by Putin as a way to bolster his credentials with right-wing nationalists ahead of the March 18 presidential election he's expected to win. We'll also assess what kind of protection former Russian spies are provided by the UK security services, given the record of high-profile hits by the Kremlin on British soil. Then we'll examine the results of the Italian election that have alarmed the EU as illiberal right-wing regimes sympathetic to Putin gain ground in Europe, with Italy's centre-right five-star movement getting the most votes at 32%, and they are expected to form a coalition with the far-right Anti-Immigrant League, which captured 17.5% of the vote. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University who writes on fascism, racism, and authoritarian rulers, joins us to discuss her article at CNN. In Italy's elections, the fascists did scarily well. Then finally, with growing concern from Republicans at home and from leaders around the world that Donald Trump is triggering a trade war because of his snap decision to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, we will speak with Matt Gold, a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He previously served as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America in the Executive Office of the President, and we will discuss whether Speaker Ryan and others will be able to convince Trump to walk back his plan as Trump threatens to double down, pressuring NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico. And joining us now from London is Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, and WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. Two of his books have been made in Hollywood movies, and his books have been translated into 30 languages. His latest book just out is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luke Harding.
Hello.
So there's been yet another poisoning of a Russian spy in London. He was found unconscious on a park bench with a young woman. Again, it seems brazen if the same author is involved. And what's the suspicion at your end?
Well, it's too early to tell precisely what has happened. We know who this is. It's someone called Sergei Skripal. He's a former Russian spy who was swapped famously in 2010 for 10 sleeper agents who were working undercover in the United States, including Anna Chapman, who became very famous. And he has been living in the UK since 2010. He used to work for the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, the same guys who allegedly hacked the 2016 US election. And he's pretty low profile. I know most people in this world. I haven't met him. And he was living actually not in London, but in Salisbury in the southwest of the UK, in an unassuming house, keeping a low profile.
So, but of course, you wrote the book on Alexander Litvinenko, A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko and Putin's War with the West. That was incredibly brazen. How would you rate this in terms of its... I mean, it feels like the authors or the intellectual authors of these attacks want it both ways. They want to send the signal that we're ruthless and we're going to get you no matter where you're hiding, and two, we're not really leaving our fingerprints, even though, wink, wink, and a nod, you know it's us.
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. If you look at the Alexander Litvinenko case, he was poisoned with a radioactive cup of tea containing polonium when he met two Kremlin assassins in a bar in a central London hotel, literally on the doorstep of the American embassy in Britain. And Putin's attitude was to say officially, look, this has nothing to do with us. You're all crazy. But then to kind of wink and nod at the Russian population and subsequently to give one of the killers, Andrei Lugovoy, a state award. Now, the context of this case, this latest case involving Sergei Skripal, is as follows, that Vladimir Putin is going into a presidential election. Everyone knows he's going to win. There is pretty apathetic mood in Russia about the whole contest. And of course, a case like this, ambiguous, not ambiguous, plays well with the base and with the kind of nationalistic mood in the country. So we don't know what happened, but there is a context.
Well, the history, though, is pretty interesting. They used to just kill their spies with a bullet in the back of the head, but this fellow was sentenced in August of 2006 in Russia to 13 years in jail for spying for the UK, convicted of high treason in the form of espionage. And Russian prosecutors said he'd been, I'm just actually reading from your article, Luke, he's been paid $100,000 by MI6. So let's talk about the spy swap. What did the West get in exchange, or what did the Russians get in exchange, I should say?
Well, actually, I was in Moscow at the time, and I remember it pretty well because I wrote a fairly sort of teasing article about Anna Chapman, who you'll remember was the most glamorous of these Russian sleeper agents, posing as a real estate developer in New York, but actually trying to get secrets for Moscow. So she went back. The other spies went back. Putin had a patriotic sing-song with them and welcomed them home as returning heroes. It was a little bit hard to figure out what precisely these spies had done. The FBI had been onto them all along. But what the UK got back were clearly, it appears, assets, agents who had been supplying them with sensitive information, of whom Sergei Skripal was one. And the whole thing was redolent of Cold War melodrama because The Russians were flown to Vienna. There was a swap on the tarmac, and then they went to the UK. And I actually just spoke to one of them, Igor Sutyagin, who was sitting next to Skripal on the flight home. And I was saying, well, what was Skripal like? And he said, well, Skripal was talking mainly about his family. Bear in mind, he'd been locked up for a long time. He was very keen to see them. And he said that he thought that Skripal's family were his most important joy.
And they had already been in the UK?
Well, no, they were imprisoned in Russia, and they were then bundled onto this plane that no one told them anything, flown to Vienna, and then exfiltrated to the UK. And Sutyagin actually has a fairly high profile. He's attached to a think tank called the Royal United Services Institute, which is quite prestigious, based in London. I've done events with him. He's well known, but Sergei Skripal, the man who appears to have been poisoned or has fallen ill, was not so high profile. You didn't see him. He didn't do events, and I think he had more or less disappeared.
But given the track record of Litvinenko and Bereshovsky, the former media baron, his death was pretty mysterious. How much is I assume, even though MI6 ran these agents, MI5's job would be to protect them, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are quite a few defectors living in the UK. I mean, Skripal is not the only one. The most famous of them, I think, is Oleg Gordievsky, who was the sort of KGB designate head of station in London. And he had been shipping secrets of British intelligence from 1974 and was recalled to Moscow in 1985 and was bundled out of the country in the back of a Saab car by MI6. They got him out. Now, He lives in Surrey. He's not that hard to find, and so far he's intact. So it's quite hard to sort of to figure out the method here. And when I saw Gordievsky, there were no police on the door. I mean, obviously there were kind of security measures, but I think the bottom line is you cannot protect people like Skripal all of the time. I mean, they have to have a life. And also people forget. I mean, 2010 is quite a long time ago, and maybe after a period in exile, you you think that you are safe. But the Litvinenko case teaches us one thing. Litvinenko fled Russia in 2000. He was poisoned in 2006. And that is that the Kremlin has a long memory.
Well, I actually went to KGB headquarters in Moscow to talk to them about Gordievsky. I was working on a movie project with Mel Gibson a long time ago, and they were he was not their favorite guy. They referred to him as Mr. G, which is a childish way of talking about a young kid sort of pooing in their pants, for want of a better description.
So, yeah, I mean the Kremlin's view is very clear of people who pass secrets to the outside, particularly to the Americans and to the British, that they are traitors. And the code, the sort of spy code, the Soviet spy code, and it's still the Russian code, is that the fate of traitors is to be liquidated, and that you understand that when you join one of these organizations, that if you betray it, then there is a death sentence. Now we know in Litvinenko's case, because there was a public inquiry, which reported back in 2016, that Vladimir Putin personally probably approved, that's the quote from the judge, probably approved the operation to kill Litvinenko. In other words, these operations are sanctioned at the very top of the state by the presidential administration. Now, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We don't know what happened to Sergei Skripal. It may be a different case. There may be a different context. But Putin's attitude to people who betray the motherland is unambiguous.
Right, but the use of whatever agents. I mean, the KGB had a division that developed all kinds of toxins. And obviously, you mentioned polonium, not a toxin, but an exotic poison, let's shall we say. Is there any indication? Because the local medical authorities didn't know what happened. These people were found, were they not, on a bus bench, both unconscious, him and the colonel and a young woman in her 30s?
Yeah, we really don't know. This is on Sunday afternoon. There are eyewitnesses who said that he looked odd, was staring at the sky. But also, if the Litvinenko case is any guide, if it is some kind of hit or murder attempt, it's often very hard to find out what the poison may be. In Litvinenko's case, polonium had never been seen before in the UK, United States. You need a nuclear reactor to produce it. And Geiger counters don't identify it because it emits alpha radiation. And I think it was seen as the perfect invisible weapon. It's tiny, it's invisible, and a microdose of this thing will kill you. So if this has been done professionally, I think it'll be hard to identify. Now, of course, it could be something else. We just don't know at this stage.
So in the context then of the election, clearly Putin has what's called, what he calls, rather euphemistically, a managed democracy. What do you think of the chances of anything happening to Sobchak's daughter? One of the more extraordinary things about Sobchak's murder, and he was Putin's mentor, and it was one of the few times that Putin has, I think perhaps the only time that Putin has broken down in tears at his funeral. Nevertheless, Sobchak's widow, and of course his daughter is running against Putin, and she sort of asked permission in a way, but some people think that she's a sort of useful idiot for Putin, so I'm not sure. Well, where do you come down on that, Luke Harding?
Well, Ksenia Sobchak, she is running against Vladimir Putin, and she's smart, she's glamorous, she's telegenic, but also I think she's systemic, which is the Russian word for it. In other words, if the Kremlin wants you to take part in an election, it will allow you, or perhaps even encourage you. And in this case, I think Ksenia Sobchak's role is to inject color into what otherwise is a very dull contest, and to give the sort of the impression of a competitive race. But if they don't want you, they won't let you. And the most formidable opposition leader in Russia is the anti-corruption campaigner Alexei Navalny. Now, he's been locked up. He's been barred from standing. They wouldn't let him register. And it's clear to me that were he allowed to stand, probably he wouldn't beat Putin. That's just impossible. But he would attract significant support in Moscow and St. Petersburg and from the disaffected middle classes. Now, he can't run. He's called for a boycott. But this is not an election in any meaningful sense of the word. It's a decorative exercise rather than a real one.
But the last thing Putin wants, though, is a boycott. I mean, that's what he's afraid of with Navalny, isn't it? And that's Sobchak's choice, right?
Sobchak doesn't want a boycott. Sobchak wants people to vote for her. There's also a kind of communist candidate as well. But But it's fake. I mean, in the same way that sort of 300 years ago, Catherine the Great would famously go past villages which were pasteboard and show with sort of happy peasants who were kind of dressed up in clothes given to them an hour before her carriage rolled by. This is just an exercise in show. It's not substantial. And Putin really, he's been in power for 18 years. He's gonna be re-elected for another 6 years. And this is an era. You can call it dictatorship. You can call it one-party rule. You can call it a personalist system. But he's not going away anytime soon. And I think I can confidently predict that he will outlast Donald Trump, Theresa May, and practically every leader in Europe.
Well, just in closing there, back to subjects. Widow, she was on the BBC recently talking about her daughter and about her husband and his relationship with Putin and his mysterious death. And there was an autopsy done which had no credibility. She ordered a second autopsy but sent the results abroad for safekeeping. And she said on camera that essentially this is my insurance policy and that in Russia today, things are extremely scary. I'm not paraphrasing it very well, but the implication that I got from Sobchak's widow was that she also talked about him breaking down Putin in tears, was that somehow this wasn't necessarily authorized by Putin, that there are shadowy figures even more powerful than Putin who wanted Putin in there but didn't want Sobchak as Putin's advisor and mentor because he was too liberal. That was the impression that I got. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, it's one version, but the reality is that it's almost impossible to tell. There have been scores of opposition MPs, critics, and troublesome journalists like Anna Politkovskaya, and also Alexander Litvinenko was a journalist as well, who was very outspoken against Putin, who have met mysterious ends. They've been shot, they've been poisoned, their planes have crashed, and it's almost impossible to find out definitively what happened inside Russia. But I think the reason the Litvinenko case is so important is it happened outside, and there was a proper dispassionate investigation by Scotland Yard, who did a painstaking job, and by the UK government. And we got a reckoning. We got the truth, which was this was an operation by the FSB, Putin's old spy agency. So anything is possible. Sometimes the Kremlin's hand is visible. Sometimes it's not visible. Sometimes it's other parties. But I suspect that given the high-profile nature of this latest case involving Sergei Skripal, that the UK authorities will take it very seriously.
Well, Luke Harding, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Luke Harding, who's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, and WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his books have been translated into 30 languages. His latest book is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. We're going to take a brief station break, back examining the results of the Italian elections, where the right is in ascendancy and the left is in retreat. Leave it till tomorrow to unpack my case. Honey, disconnect the phone. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the U.S., back in the U.S., back in the USSR. Well, the delivery girls really knocked me out. Want you to tell me, love and bring me life. Come on, baby, try to do it, I'm not playing now. Want you to give me shiny love somehow. But you won't listen, that delay. There's something missing, and now you just can't wait. Do you really wanna go? Do you wanna let it go? Do you, I love you, I won't let you go. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiata, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, and has an article at CNN in Italy's Elections, The Fascists Did Scarily Well. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiata. So when you look at these results, in effect, the five-star movement in coalition with the far-right anti-immigrant league basically got 50% of the vote, right? Five-star got 32%, and the league got 17.5%. And Berlusconi, he's down to 14%. And, of course, the center-left Democratic Party received just 19%. So is this a foregone conclusion that you'll have a right-wing coalition?
Pretty much. I think, you know, when Berlusconi becomes too moderate just because he wants to stay in the Eurozone, it shows you how far Italy is shifting to the right, because Berlusconi was the one who opened the Pandora's box of bringing the right to the government in 1994 in the first place. And it's like he's been overtaken by a more extremist right, which now takes the form of the League and to some extent the Five Star Movement.
Well, of course, Berlusconi was Putin's favorite Western leader. They were actually, I think, pretty close friends, or perhaps still are. But the head of the League, Matteo Salvini, he also is enamored with Putin, is he not?
Yes, and so, you know, the big picture is that with this election and the emergence of Salvini, you have Italy lining itself up in this kind of what I call Axis 0.2, you know, Axis 2.0 without Germany, under the guide of Putin, this kind of new global illiberal order. Salvini loves to be photographed with Donald Trump and, you know, Erdogan and Putin especially, and Russian Sputnik Italia was very active in spreading far-right propaganda during the campaign. So you have Italy coming into this larger picture of a shift of the sort that, in our own way, we've in the United States seen as well.
Well, it's only happening in the United States because of our leader, though, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
This is the amazing thing, isn't it, that we still to this day cannot understand what it is that Putin holds over Trump, because he is literally, as the former director of national intelligence said, for all intents and purposes, Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's case officer.
Yes, and that's very true. But I think that I'm always happy to blame Trump for almost everything. But we can't leave out the role of the GOP with their own heavy Russian connections, which have not been fully, you know, that story remains to be fully told. And for example, there was the recent conservative conference that's known as CPAC. There was a reason that Marion Le Pen, you know, the niece of the far-right Front National family, was invited to have a premier spot to speak at that, you know, that prized Republican conference right around in the same session as Vice President Pence. And that's a very deliberate move to put her in such a prominent spot. So the GOP has long had these links with the far right, you know, figures such as Steve King of Iowa. But now it seems that the party leadership and Pence are kind of making these connections with the global right and Russia as well.
And it's very instructive that during the election back in 2016, when the American intelligence services all got together and recognized that Russia was interfering in the elections, the leadership of the House and Senate were brought together by the Obama administration, but the head of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, and the head of the House, Paul Ryan, would not go along with a joint statement, which Obama felt was necessary and nonpartisan, to condemn what the Russians were doing. And the reasons for that still to this day remain somewhat mysterious. I mean, I understand they didn't want to get embarrassed and didn't want to lose an election, but they were not acting as Americans. They were acting as partisans.
That's right.
So I imagine some of this stuff will be answered, at least one hopes, by the special counsel. How much, though, is the – I mean, we know that Donald Trump used racist populism in his campaign. In fact, he started his campaign insulting Mexicans and then went on to want to kick Muslims out and build a wall, and we know all of that stuff. How much is the anti-immigrant issue central to this election? I mean, there was a very grisly murder of an Italian woman who was dismembered by a Nigerian immigrant. That's apparently – the press beat the hell out of that story. But there are people crossing from Libya, you know, risking their lives, many drowning on the way, showing up on Italy's shores, I think pretty much on a daily basis. So give us the picture of how that's affecting both the politics and Italian society.
It's affected it hugely, and in part it is the same kind of xenophobia that is hitting all over Europe and in our country as well, the urge to deport, to wall off the country. And Italy is in the front line because of its geographic, you know, proximity to North Africa and its abundant coastlines. And almost every, you know, center-right candidate talked about what he would do with the 500,000 to 600,000, the numbers differ, immigrants who have arrived over the last 5 years. And Berlusconi said he would deport them all and send soldiers into the streets, you know, to help the police. And again, in a country with a 20-year-plus history of fascism, to say you're going to send soldiers is quite a statement. But Salvini has been, since 2016, actually talking about ethnic cleansing. That year he said Italy needs a, quote, controlled ethnic cleansing. And then recently, in the run-up to this election, he said Italy needs a, quote, a mass cleansing, street by street, neighborhood by neighborhood. So that is unmistakably fascistic, you know, language to use in the context of Italy. So although there were real economic worries that led, in particular, young people to vote for the Five Star Movement, there's 35% youth unemployment in Italy, and this is a huge problem. You know, people have to leave the country to get jobs, and there's a feeling that the Democratic Party was not able to come up with, you know, an adequate reform and labor politics scheme. And so there are these economic anxieties, but the candidates really went to town in upping racial anxieties as well.
So why then is, I mean, obviously it's the correct way to describe the politics of the Five Star Movement as being on the right. But that was not the impression I got when the comedian or the clown or the comic Beppe Grillo formed this party back in 2009. It was almost as though it was a protest or even a joke. So how did it morph politically into the right, where it could be a part of a governing coalition with this very far right Salvini fellow that you were just telling us about? What happened there? Because was Grillo just a sort of dilettante, or how did they move to the right or capture the center right?
They have moved to the right. They're not the worst offenders in terms of they're not having this kind of quasi genocidal rhetoric, but the whole country has shifted to the right, and so they have gone with it. But they say the Five Star Movement says that they can't be described as either left or right wing. And so there's been a lot of mystique about their positions. I mean, they have a very eclectic mix of environmentalism, you know, Euroscepticism. They believe in kind of a direct democracy via the internet. They're against science, like in the sense of being against vaccinations. And so they seem very fresh and appealing. And they also offered they've offered a kind of universal basic income. And this appeals to young people quite a lot. They've gone back and forth about their policy on immigrants, but now, you know, they've been much more vocal, again, not to the extent of the other two in the center-right coalition. But, you know, even what happens when you have these shifts is even the Democratic Party has had to take a tougher stance, at least rhetorically, on immigrants, because that is where the wind has gone nowadays. And one thing I would like to say is that you know, part of what the five-star, they're split between these kind of idealists, which is their founders, Beppe Grillo, and then they have a 31-year-old head of the party, Luigi Di Maio, who has practically no experience. He'd never had a real job before he was elected as a politician 5 years ago. And so Di Maio has been the pragmatist. And so, you know, the founders said, no, we're not going to make any coalitions. We won't rule with anyone. Now, it's obvious they can't take part in the government if they're not going to be part of a governing alliance or a coalition. So their principles are going to be tested and sacrificed. And this win, this huge win they've had, they were the party that got the single party that got the most votes. We'll see what happens to them over the next years. It's going to be very interesting.
Well, you say he's never had a job. Well, with a third of Italy's youth unemployed, that's not a surprise, right? And did that work for him, his age, rather than work against him?
It did, and he also has no college degree. And so this is important in that the Democratic Party, which, of course, traditionally was the party of emotional attachment for the working class. It's really important that, you know, to know that Italy had the largest left in Western Europe for over a century. And with this election, certain kind of, they used to be called the Red Belt in kind of northern central Italy that was reliably left from the days of communism to, you know, liberal, kind of liberal left now. It's kind of splintered, and a lot of them didn't vote for the left anymore. So the Democratic Party started to seem very elitist, and in fact had split into two. Some of the left went into a new party called Free and Equal because they felt that Matteo Renzi was too pro-business. So they're in a dilemma about their fundamental identity. And so here we have Luigi Di Maio, a five-star who has no college degree, who's young, and can't be called an elitist in any way. And so this played, again, it was part of this freshness and newness that's part of the populist revolt that we see in Italy and all over Europe.
Well, certainly the Social Democratic parties are just evaporating, are they not, throughout Europe? I know that in Germany, Merkel has had to form a coalition with the largely unpopular and discredited Social Democrats, but that was her only choice because of Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party, being the third biggest party now. So it seems to me the trends are pretty stark and clear, aren't they? The right is in resurgence, the left is in retreat.
Yes, and the left has just, the left, center-left even, has been unable to come out with a really strong, passionate program that's going to, you know, kind of counter some of these things, and also doesn't want to, quote, go there in terms of, you know, anti-immigrant and the overt racism that seems to be the emotional charge of a lot of these right-wing parties now. That's what's selling. And so they have a dilemma of principle as well as platform.
So how much do you, we talked about the U.S. and some of the kind of analogies or comparisons, if you will, with the right here and Trump's affection for the right and the right in Italy now doing so well in this election over the weekend. But in terms of democratic values and standing up for them, there's nothing more appalling than the fact that Donald Trump essentially has endorsed the fact that Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, has abandoned or gotten rid of term limits and essentially declared himself dictator for life. And Donald Trump thinks that's fine and went on to say that he's a great guy, Xi Jinping, and he treated me really well.
Well. Yes, so this is his power. Everything is personal for Donald Trump. So if somebody treated him well, then he's okay no matter what his platform is. And there's also the fact that Donald Trump joked, you know, between quotes, that maybe, you know, we should try this, you know, maybe we'll end up with this here too. And this is one of his, what I call his trial balloons, where he throws out these provocative or extra legal notions because part of him likes those notions and he would perhaps, you know, want to do things, the things he jokes about if he could. But the effect of hearing things like that is, you know, some people say words don't matter, but in fact, the effect is that it puts ideas into people's heads and it kind of expands the space of what is possible to think about in a democracy. So, you know, abolishing term limits and having a really overt presidentialism or return in China's case, return to almost Mao, you know, status, is something that Donald Trump would be sympathetic to. He's made no secret of his admiration for foreign despots. And in fact, he doesn't admire anybody but foreign despots, and especially Putin. So this is pretty clear.
But if you combine the illiberal direction or the reversal of any hope of democracy in China, coupled with its rising economic power, and then the illiberal regime in Russia about to have Putin re-elected in a phony election, and then, as you mentioned earlier, with Salvini, the far-right candidate who got almost 80% of the vote, wanting to be associated with Viktor Orban, and also the Polish government is moving to the right, and Marine Le Pen is still there in France, etc. Unless somebody stands up for democracy with this illiberal trend, and, you know, I forgot to mention the Turkish leader and others, I mean, it's just clear that if you looked at the globe and in the old days, I grew up in the British Empire, for God's sake, and it was all red, you know, in our maps. But now it seems to be, if you did the illiberal regimes, it would seem almost as though that was the new empire. And unless somebody stands up against it, isn't it inexorable?
It could be. I'm writing a book on strongmen, and one of the points that I'm making actually to do with the speaking of the British Empire is that there's a lot of recurrences between the rhetoric of the, you know, 1920s and 30s and now, but there's one thing that's different that really this has flown under the radar a bit. Back then, you had fascist states, you had the British and French Empire and other empires. After that, you had apartheid. These were all regimes and states that kept non-white people, quote, in their place. They all restricted the mobility, you know, ability to move around and intermarriage. There were all kinds of regulations on imperial subjects, et cetera. And now all of that is gone. There's no, all of these racial regimes and empires are gone. So, you know, who's going to control the movement of these people now? And so it's no wonder the migrant, you know, experience comes up and they're coming by the boatloads to through Libya into Italy, that there's this kind of renewed panic. And some of the right think, well, this is worse than ever. We don't have any mechanism to hold them back. And so you see the fantasies of walls and fences and borders and camps are coming back to us.
Well, they're not fantasies, they're realities, though, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the case of Trump and his wall,
sure.
It remains a fantasy.
I join you in that hope, and I thank you for joining us here today, Ruth Ben-Gvir.
We must find the humor in this not very good situation. So
no,
thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Gvir, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images, and has an article at CNN, In Italy's Elections, The Fascists Did Scarily Well. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the growing concern from Republican leaders at home and from leaders around the world that Donald Trump is triggering a trade war. Button.
money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound,
a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound
is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Gold, who's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business and on renegotiation of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements. He's been consulted by the White House, the National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he advised President Obama's re-election campaign and Secretary Clinton's recent presidential campaign on trade policy. He previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Gold.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, Matt. And what do you make of this growing concern from Republican leaders at home and from leaders around the world that Donald Trump is triggering a trade war because of his snap decision to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum imports?
Well, it wasn't a snap decision. It's been coming for some time. But the fact is that the fact that his own party, along with his opposition party leaders around the world, are universally very, very scared right now is a good example of how seriously dangerous the situation is. President Trump is being advised by only three people to do this: the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, who made a fortune in the steel industry, the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer, who practiced law for more than 35 years representing, among others, steel and aluminum companies, and probably expects to go back to the same clients after he leaves office. I think they both have conflicts of interest. This move helps steel and aluminum, the U.S. steel and aluminum sectors, at the cost of every other American sector and at other costs. Everyone else inside the White House, in the U.S. government, U.S. Congress, and foreign leaders thinks that this is a very dangerous move.
Well, it doesn't look as if Donald Trump, though, is, I mean, when Paul Ryan is asking him to reconsider his plan, instead it seems like Trump is doubling down. He's going after Canada and Mexico and basically saying if they don't, you know, come up with new and what he calls fair talks in this renegotiation of NAFTA, he's using the renegotiation NAFTA as a way to double down on the people who are going to be affected. As we know, Canada is going to be the main victim of these tariffs.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of victims of these tariffs, but Canada is the biggest exporter of both steel and aluminum. Donald Trump doubling down is a very typical thing. Anytime somebody calls his hand, he's bluffing. All he does is raise and re-raise. It's almost like a cartoon sequence where one cartoon character draws a chalk line across the road and his nemesis just steps right over it and he doesn't know what to do. So he draws a line, a second line, and nemesis steps over that and he doesn't know what to do and he draws 10 lines and nemesis steps over all 10. It's a cartoon character routine, but that's literally what Donald Trump does. And we've seen him do this in other trade negotiation situations.
So how much do then, given Wilbur Ross's background, and he was clearly the Trump whisperer along with Peter Navarro, who's not highly regarded in any academic and policy circles that I can identify, but Wilbur Ross, as you pointed out, made his fortune in buying distressed American steel companies cheap and selling them at vast profits, and of course the trade representative represented these companies. Is that what could be driving it? I mean, we've had revelations of Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, making all kinds of attempts to rescue 666 Fifth Avenue from the $1.4 billion balloon payment and perhaps making all kinds of attempts at even shaking down the Qataris for $500 million. So the ethical lines between government service and private interest have all been erased in this White House. So Trump is hardly setting an example himself, is he?
No, not at all. And Peter Navarro is the third of the three advisors whom I was talking about earlier as advising Trump to do this. As an economist, he's an outlier. at best, but also more importantly, he's not a lawyer. He would not recognize a trade agreement if one fell out of the sky and landed on his head. He doesn't know anything about the international law of international trade or the national law of international trade. He doesn't understand the implications of what he's advising.
So, and you do. So tell us what impact this will have on the World Trade Organization, because it seems like Donald Trump is pretty cavalier about, you know, he's breaking the China right, left, and center, shall we say.
Yeah, he's smashing up the entire China shop. It's a mutually assured destruction scenario for the global economy. I mean, first of all, in addition, of course, raising prices for steel and aluminum, which has a chain reaction of inflationary pressures inside the United States, he's violating WTO rules. The World Trade Organization agreements, which are the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade from 1947, and 30 other agreements that we've negotiated since, that 164 countries have joined. As a group, they're not only the international law of international trade, but they make up, you couldn't really quantify this, but probably more than 90% of all the international law in the world. And it is the single most stabilizing force there is in the world for global security as well as the global economy, in addition to the fact that literally all trade, not just of goods but of services, you know, intellectual property, international movement of capital, all of it relies on national rules of 164 countries, which themselves have to fit into the framework of those countries' obligations in the WTO agreement. If you pull out the pillars of the foundation of the global trading system, you could collapse the global economy. And this is not just violating a WTO rule. This is a major violation of major rules by the world's foundational economy and the United States, which is the architect of the entire global trading system.
Well, we're already very puzzled by Donald Trump's peculiar and very opaque relationship with Putin, who he refuses to criticize or impose any reciprocal, certainly not tariffs, any punishment for the meddling in our elections. And just recently, Putin showed animation on national television in Russia ahead of his election campaign, or his re-election campaign, of his new nuclear missiles striking Florida, where Donald Trump spends a lot of time, and there wasn't a peep out of Trump. So that's very puzzling. But now it seems that the same mysterious, whatever it is, relationship exists with China and Trump. Trump gave China the greatest gift of all by getting rid of TPP, and it's hard not to notice that now that China is unrestrained in that neighborhood, China is now moving the clock back with President Xi declaring himself dictator for life. And what does our president do? Instead of standing up for democratic values, he basically praises Xi for that move and almost implies that he wishes he could be a leader for life too. So we seem to have a fundamental problem here that our president is not standing up for America. He's wrecking America, undermining America, weakening America, and seems to be absolutely in the pocket of both Russia and China.
Well, there's little question about the fact that Donald Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, the TPP, was an astounding gift to China and to Russia. It would have put both those countries in a very tight corner, as not only 12 Pacific countries had signed, but many other important Pacific economies were lining up to sign it after it entered into force. Fairly soon, every country touching the Pacific other than China, Russia, and North Korea would have been members, and possibly India and Pakistan that don't touch the Pacific. So it would have put China and Russia in a corner. We really would have had extraordinary leverage over them for about 50 years, because it would have taken that long for those two countries to get over the sticker shock of what they would have to do to join the TPP and then go through a long process to negotiate it and then go through a long process to come into compliance. That's tremendous leverage the United States would have had over Russia and China as the gatekeeper for TPP until they fully join, which would have taken 50 to 70 years. And Trump just threw it away. It is just astounding.
Well, there are reports today, incredible reports, that the Kremlin, Putin, advised Donald Trump not to select Mitt Romney as his Secretary of State, but instead to select a friend of Russia's, Rex Tillerson. I mean, I guess we have to wait for the full information to come out, hopefully, with the special counsel, Robert Mueller. But Are there any explanations for this? When you just explain to us, to our audience, the damage that Donald Trump did in this cavalier way of just tearing up the TPP, which was more of a political document than a trading document, in as much as it was forcing China to play by the rules of the neighborhood which the U.S. and the neighbors were going to impose. And therefore, that would have had the effect of liberalizing and democratizing China. Now we see the reverse is happening. We see a kind of growth of illiberal regimes around the world led by China and Russia, and we just had the results in Italy indicating that the trend is happening in Europe as well. So I hope you can understand why I'm thrashing around here trying to find out what is going on here. What is the motive? Why is this man undermining our strength and our future? And he's the leader of our country.
Yeah, it is something that every American should be wrestling with. We're looking at a very dangerous situation. The TPP would have very much empowered a lot of reformers in China, and when we threw it away, China started slipping backwards. There's no question about that. As far as Rex Tillerson, you know, you don't want to go too far down that road until we see what Mueller comes up with. But Tillerson, if I understand it correctly, and this I'm not an expert on, but he was an oil executive and spent an enormous amount of time in Russia, I think in the 80s and the 90s. The Russians were very, very predatory at that time. He was a young man and also middle-aged man, predatory with, you know, compromising people whom they thought they would be able to blackmail at later stages of their career. Frankly, a lot of people in the United States were very nervous when Tillerson was named to be Secretary of State for that reason. It's one of the things that led the original investigation, the FBI investigation before Mueller under Comey, to be started up. And Tillerson has been viewed as one of the more stable people in this administration. So people tend to forget how much concern there was initially about the amount of time that Tillerson spent in Russia and whether Tillerson had been compromised at some point by the Russian FSB or the SVR, which are the two successors to the Russian KGB. There's just a great deal of concern about that. There's a great deal of concern about everything going on. It's really a very scary situation for American democracy and democracy in the free world.
So, Matt Gold, to be trying to figure out a way to be charitable here to Trump or to give him the benefit of the doubt, could you suggest then that a lot of what he's doing is just acting out of incredible nativist ignorance? Look at the tweet that came out today. We have large trade deficits with Mexico and Canada. NAFTA, which is under renegotiation right now, has been a bad deal for USA. Massive relocations in companies and jobs. Tariffs on steel and aluminum will only come off if a new and fair NAFTA agreement is signed. So the question would be, is he acting out of ignorance because he doesn't seem to understand what trade deficits are? And two, is he doing this because he can do it? I mean, he campaigned on it, as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation. But is he doing it because he can do it? Otherwise, you know, everything around him is collapsing because he's a manifest incompetent.
I'll tell you this. He completely fails to understand that trade agreements have a relatively small impact on trade balance, including trade deficits. A lot of things affect trade deficits. Things like interest rates and exchange rates, a lot of other things affect trade deficits. Most fundamentally, whether you're making a lot of goods and services that people in other countries want to buy versus whether they're making goods and services that people in your country want to buy. These are the things that drive trade surplus and trade deficit or what we call trade balance. But the trade, you know, trade agreement isn't going to have a huge impact pushing trade balance one way or the other, especially when you look at an agreement like NAFTA on a scale from 1 to 100. It's about a 92, always has been. If Trump got everything he wanted on his wish list, he would improve it to about a 96. He won't. He'll improve it from a 92 to a 93 at best if Canada and Mexico don't walk out. Not only do a trade agreement have a very small impact on trade balance, but you're improving NAFTA from a 92 to a 93 in this trade negotiation. The impact that's going to have on the trade balance between U.S. Mexico and U.S. Canada is almost nothing. He doesn't understand these things. But I can tell you this, you know, I replied to his tweet that having been a lead U.S. trade negotiator with Mexico and Canada, in connection with NAFTA issues. I can tell you that Mexicans and Canadians are not going to respond to this by giving him additional concessions. They might just walk away from the table at this point. I think there's a real risk of that. I haven't heard anything, but knowing their sensibility, I think there's a risk they'll walk away from the table. But if they don't, they're not going to give him anything additional, and he's still going to be looking at a large number of very small improvements to NAFTA, which may be improving from a 92 to a 93 and not getting his big requests in the NAFTA renegotiation.
And he's certainly not getting his wall, right, from the Mexicans.
the Mexican a wall built by the United States inside the United States for the United States purposes, whatever those are, and Mexico is going to pay for it. That was hilarious.
Well, it seems to be the reason why the visit between the two leaders was canceled, though.
Yes. Well, the Mexican leader, President Enrique Peña Nieto, canceled a summit over that. A year ago, and then the summit was canceled again recently, their second attempt at that summit. It is just beyond absurd. And what you do is get foreign leaders walking away from summits, walking away from trade negotiations. No world leader is going to allow themselves to be subject to that kind of insult. It's never going to happen. He does not understand diplomacy. He does not understand trade diplomacy.
And the foundation of this decision that he made to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum is based upon national security concerns. And, of course, it doesn't punish Russia or China. It punishes Mexico and Japan and South Korea and most of all Canada. So that on its surface should be clear to everybody, the hollow nature of his justification.
Well, yeah, I mean, although the intention there is not to help national security by punishing America's adversaries or helping America's allies, it's to help national security in the theory that if there were a World War III that disrupted ocean shipping, and you can really only import steel and aluminum in real volume by ocean freight, you can't do it by air freight, would we have enough capacity for our domestic steel needs? We would definitely have enough capacity for the war effort. Our Secretary of Defense recently confirmed that. But would we have enough steel capacity for our entire economy plus the war effort? And actually, we probably wouldn't, which is why under the U.S. statute, having done the investigation to show that he is empowered to impose those duties, but under the World Trade Organization rules, he has to have more than a theoretical future scenario that he can envisage where this would be a problem. Under the World Trade Organization rules, he has to be at war now, or we have to have an emergency in international relations right now in order for us to get the exception to the other WTO rules we would have to impose these tariffs. So he has the authority under U.S. law. There is a national security need, but it doesn't rise to the level that would let us do this under the WTO rules.
Sure, and there's no ocean between the U.S. and Canada or the U.S. and Mexico.
That's the big irony, which, by the way, no one has really observed. But in truth, the measure should be one that increases steel capacity in the North American continent. And if it increased capacity in Canada and Mexico, where we don't have to ship it by ocean freight to get to the United States, that should be consistent with the objective of the measure. So he could conceivably exclude Mexico and Canada on that basis from the sanctions. But at the end of the day, he's going the other direction. He's trying to use it to as blackmail with the NAFTA renegotiation. I just cannot see the Mexican or Canadian government giving a millimeter in exchange for that, and I really do think there's a risk they walk away from the table altogether at the NAFTA renegotiation.
Well, Matt Gold, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Gold, who's a professor of law at Fordham University, where he teaches international trade law. He frequently consults with U.S. business on the renegotiation of NAFTA and other U.S. trade agreements and has been consulted by the White House, the National Security Council staff, State Department, and members of Congress on issues at the intersection of trade and national security. And he's advised President Obama's re-election campaign and Secretary Clinton's recent presidential campaign on trade policy. And he previously held an appointment within the executive office of the president as the Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for North America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.